John Baker is always behind on whatever show you want to talk about.
Wait, there's dragons?
John has just discovered planking.
Check me out! It's called planking!
So naturally, John hasn't tried Taco Bell's Quesalupa yet. While everyone's experiencing delicious melted pepper jack cheese baked right into the shell, John is probably making an ice bucket challenge video.
It's so cold! It's so cold!
Don't be late like John. Taste what everyone is talking about. The Quesalupa. Order now at TacoBell.com. At participating locations for a limited time while supplies last.
Blog Talk Radio.
It's not the same in other towns along the coast, both up and down. There's nowhere else, just look around. It's feels like home to me. It's called Lake Worth in Florida. On any map you'll see, from John Prince Park to Ocean Shore, it feels like home to me. A sleepy town most of the time, taking a show, drink beer or wine. Cool little shops, no waiting lines, it feels like home to me. There's ocean views and fancy cars, tiki bars where you can count the stars. Be neighbors to Manuel or Lars, it feels like home to me.
Welcome to another edition of High Noon in Lake Worth. I'm Wes Blackman, your host, and for the next hour, we'll have a very interesting guest. Lyra Keith is somewhat of a Renaissance woman. She is a writer, a small farmer, and radical feminist activist. She's an author of two novels, as well as a work of nonfiction, and she's also associated with the Deep Green Resistance Movement. And you might remember a former High Noon in Lake Worth guest was Rachel Ivey, who's also associated with the movement. Some of her works that we're going to be talking about, and one I did find on Amazon.com, and it's available in a Kindle edition. That's The Vegetarian Myth, Food, Justice, and Sustainability by PM Press, published in 2009. And I have that on my Kindle now, and it's interesting reading. It has been called the most important ecological book of this generation by some people. She's co-author with Derek Jensen and Eric McBay of the Deep Green Resistance Strategy to Save the Planet, the Seven Stories Press, published in 2011. And she's the editor of the Derek Jensen Reader, Writings on the Environmental Revolution. And that's the Seven Stories Press, published in 2012. She's also been arrested 6 times. And she does have a website. It is LierKeith.com, LierreKeith.com, and you can get the latest information on her and what she's up to right now. She will be calling in from California today and joining us in just a few minutes. Some of the work that she has on her website, one is called The Earth at Risk, Building a Resistance Movement to Save the Planet. The annual conference, Earth at Risk, Building a Resistance Movement to Save the Planet, features environmental thinkers and activists who are willing to ask the hardest questions about the seriousness of the planet's situation. And this book presents an impassioned critique of the dominant culture from every angle. And Earth at Risk, there is a DVD set available, part of a conference convened by Derek Jensen, featured thinkers and activists who are willing to ask the hardest questions about the seriousness of our situation. So I am looking forward to Lierre, and I think she's calling in now. Welcome, Lierre. This is Wes Blackman. You're on High Noon in Lake Worth.
Oh, thanks for having me on the show.
Yeah. Where are you calling from, just out of curiosity? Northern California?
Yeah, I live in Northern California.
Okay. And how long have you lived there?
Oh, 4 years now.
Oh, okay. Well, I'm interested to find out, you really are quite a Renaissance person, and I'm interested to find out what your focus is now and what your activities are. And obviously you have quite a bit of work behind you, and I was fortunate enough to get on my Kindle last night, and I downloaded the Vegetarian Myth book, so we can touch on that too. But I'm interested in what you're focusing on right now.
Well, right now I'm writing a book about the restoration of grasslands, because I think that's actually the only hope that our planet has. It's really the only thing that's going to sequester all the carbon, which is slated to kill life on Earth. So I think the only thing we can do is reverse the destruction that is agriculture and try to repair, you know, what's been destroyed. I think there is still time for our planet. I know there are people who have given up, but I have not. And in fact, there was just an article that came out last week about all the farms in Russia that have been abandoned and that have, in fact, returned to native grasslands, and the amount of carbon that they've stored. And it's just extraordinary what grasses can do. So that's the book that I'm writing now. And I'm also involved just politically in, you know, various organizations that I work with.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting you bring up the grasslands. I have a good friend in Michigan who is part of a prairie restoration organization, and periodically they have fires because of fire suppression. That kind of thing has really damaged some of the native grasses, and mm-hmm. they don't have an opportunity to spring up in some of the other flora and fauna that depend on that. Are there ways to promote prairie? Because most of the Midwestern part of the country where the breadbasket is or where the grain is grown used to be prairie land.
Yeah, that's true around the globe. 99% of the world's prairies have been destroyed. That's a really grim statistic. They're just gone. And as Richard Manning puts it, you know, when you look at a wheat field, you're looking at a clear cut of the grass forest. They may not be as majestic on first sight as, say, a redwood forest, you know, or an old-growth oak forest or something, but they really are every bit as wonderful. And they are just incredibly important for life on Earth, terrestrial life anyway, life on Earth to continue. I mean, they do so much for us, and we're not even aware of it. And this is really what we've destroyed by taking up the...
Yeah. Well, I'm just thinking of the soil conservation. You know, there was a reason that those prairies were there in order to maintain a soil base. And as we have mass scale erosion because of our simple ecological systems that have set up under mechanized agriculture, we're losing our topsoil.
Yeah. I mean, most of the Midwest, the prairie soil was so deep, it was 8, 10, 12 feet deep when the Europeans first broke it, and at this point it can only be measured in inches, so it's gone. But this is true around the globe, and we've essentially skinned the planet alive. You know, the topsoil has just been skimmed right off.
So is that just the nature of human civilization? I happen to be an urban planner, so to some degree I deal with the impact of the built environment on the ecological environment. And is there anything intrinsic in the human species and the genome, if you boil it down to that, that does not allow us to really respect the environment? And are we just ravenous pigs out there and rats?
my answer is no. But, you know, obviously this is the kind of thing that people have deep disagreements about. And the reason that I say no is because really for 2.5 million years, we lived on this planet and we didn't destroy things. And we lived as hunter-gatherers. We lived inside those biotic communities. Mm-hmm. And we took our nourishment, our basic needs were met by participating inside biotic communities. And it's only been in the last 10,000 mm-hmm. years that we've become these destroyers. And it really only started in 7 places around the globe. So that's it. That's the extent of it. And Lorraine Cordain, who's an expert in Paleolithic nutrition, he uses the image of a football field. So if that football field represents our entire history, the entire time we've been on this planet. It's only in the last mm-hmm. quarter yard that agriculture begins, that people settle into what's called civilization. And it's only that last one-fifth of an inch of a football field that represents the industrial era. So that's the time that this destruction has taken place. But that whole, the other vast sweep of our time on this planet, we didn't do these things. You know, we had a totally different material base to the culture, and it was not about destroying it. It wasn't about, you know, wiping it out. It was about participating. And I always like to mm-hmm. reference the cave painting at this point because, you know, the first art we ever made, you can look at paintings, that, you know, like from Lascaux and the different famous caves, but to me that's just so obvious, the awe and respect and that sense of thanksgiving that, you know, we were compelled to make art because our sense of thank you was so strong. You know, our brains had gotten right. to the point where we could think, you know, in terms of representation and in terms of art. And that was what we were compelled to draw, were these, the giant megafauna that were making our brains possible, that gave us the nutrition, that gave mm-hmm. us life. And that's what I see when I look at those cave paintings, is just that incredible sense of awe and thanksgiving. I don't see, you know, destructive, rabid, you know, ravening monsters. I see people who were saying thank you.
Okay. So somehow we have developed a system that is set on destroying rather than building and sustaining. So how do you turn that ship around?
Well, you know, the first thing is that we have to understand what the destruction is. And this is really why I wrote that book, The Vegetarian Myth, is because I felt like the people who cared the most about the planet didn't really understand the scope of the destruction and weren't able to name the underlying problem of what that destruction was. And I include myself in this. I was a vegan for 20 years, and I thought I was doing the right thing. Now, as it turned out, I was just participating in the most destructive activity that people have done to the planet, and that's agriculture.
Wow.
So I want to explain this to people because I really want the people who care the most to understand the problem that we're facing. Because right now, mostly they don't. There's very little awareness in the environmental movement, in the community, that agriculture is the problem, that that's the basic wound. So that is, you know, part of my job is to try to explain this to people. So I can do that now if you'd like.
I think it's important to focus on the biology of the human being and our brain size and what our nutritional requirements really are. And I'd be interested to know what you're eating this week.
Well, so I try
like,
to eat...
How has your diet changed? Right.
Right. Well, I try to follow what's called a Paleolithic diet. My belief is that we have, you know, Paleolithic bodies, and the best nutrition for those bodies is going to be what we evolved eating. So my diet is based around... I eat a lot of bone broth. So the bones are important because there's a lot of minerals in them, and most Americans aren't getting enough anywhere near... the level of minerals that we, in fact, evolved eating. I eat a lot of grass-fed beef and bison. I eat eggs from pasture-raised chickens. All of this is important. What the animals eat affects the nutrition of the food really profoundly. So if you're eating food that's factory-farmed, if you're eating beef or eggs or whatever that comes from an animal that was just stuffed corn, you're not going to be getting appropriate nutrition. The amino acid profile is wrong, and the fatty acid profile is wrong, which that's getting technical. I can clock that out if you want me to get into more detail. But the food itself is not going to be adequate to meet the needs of the human template. So, for instance, one of the problems with corn is that it doesn't have any tryptophan in it, which is an essential amino acid for humans. And when they say essential, what they mean is we cannot produce it. We can only eat it. So our bodies cannot manufacture it. You know, no matter how many precursors we give it, the body can't do it. So it's got to be eaten. It has to be consumed. And tryptophan, of course, if you're anybody who's had depression or somebody in your life has depression, you know that tryptophan is the precursor to serotonin, right? So without tryptophan, you're going to be depressed. So the problem with corn is that there's no tryptophan in it. So you give it to cows, and of course, it's miserable from beginning to end for those cows in those situations. I think we can all agree to that. But you feed them corn, and then what happens is the products that come from those animals, whether it's meat or milk or whatever, is going to be low in tryptophan because they can't actually produce it either. So you feed them low tryptophan food like corn, you get a low tryptophan product. And this is one of the reasons I believe that we have this epidemic of depression across the country is factory farming, is that low tryptophan corn that is at the base of the whole thing. That's what makes it all possible is cheap corn. Yeah, there's probably other reasons that we've got depression, but, you know, there's this absolute epidemic of depression and all kinds of disorders in young children that, you know, people just didn't see two generations ago. And I really am fingering the factory farm, the corn, is the basis of it.
The factory farm you mentioned, and, of course, we have the reality of slaughterhouses and that kind of thing. Do you think there is a spiritual residue or component that comes from eating meat that might have gone through a very traumatic process in terms of processing it and getting it to your local Safeway or your Publix? And do you think that somehow the human psyche is harmed by that?
I do think that. Obviously, that's not something that can be proved. But it's hard to imagine that we could have this much suffering going into our culture and then into our bodies and not be affected by it. Because I think a lot of people sort of do everything in their power not to know how bad it is out there because it's overwhelming.
Right.
I understand that. A lot of people just can't. They can't handle that level of grief. And especially when it's such a powerless kind of grief, you know, we feel so powerless as individuals. But I mean, just me psychologically, I'm always someone who wants to know. No matter how bad it is, I'd rather know the truth. I find that easier than running. So for me, I'd rather stand and face it. And obviously, I don't think we're going to get to a better world unless some of us are willing to look at the bare facts. And they're not pleasant right now. You know, all of life on Earth is under assault. We may not make it to the next century. You know, that's how bad it is. And there's no good running from that. But that includes, you know, what's happening to wild animals. It includes what's happening to domestic animals. 200 species are going extinct every day. And to sit with that level of grief, I think, can just be so overwhelming to people. And it's the same with factory farming.
Well,
it's just so horrible, you know, to look at that level of torture.
Right.
It's like, you know, I understand why I was motivated to become a vegan. You know, that hasn't gone away.
Mm-hmm. When you boil it all down, you know, we do have to survive, and there are 7 billion people on the planet. Humans have been successful in part due to industrial processes. What I'm getting at is that the overriding problem, really overpopulation and being too successful as a species?
Right. Now, this is something that a lot of people are afraid to talk about, and I don't think that we should be. I think that, I mean, from my perspective, it's not humans versus planet Earth. It's actually humans with the Earth is really the only solution. So it's true. I mean, it's the industrial age happened starting around 1800, and the human population explodes. I mean, there were 1 billion of us in 1800, and now, what is it, 8 billion? I mean, it's just absolutely astronomical, the numbers that we've added, and this is all because of fossil fuel. There's another huge blip that happens with the so-called Green Revolution, and it's literally because we learned to eat oil. The Haber-Bosch process is, you know, the chemical process by which usable nitrogen is extracted, is made from oil and gas. And from there, you can apply it to fields and grow an extraordinary amount of corn. And that's what made factory farming possible, and it's what made a quadrupling of the human population possible. Okay, we are eating fossil fuel. Now, this is not a plan with the future. I mean, that fuel is going to run out someday. No matter how good the scientists get at yanking it out of the ground, the day is still going to come when there is no more of it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so, you know, face that fact. But to my mind, I don't actually think this is a tough one because there's already 32 countries around the globe that have zero or negative population growth. And in fact, this has been studied really deeply, you know, really widely. There's not a mystery involved anymore. And the two things that drop the birth rate dramatically, there's just two. And one is that you teach a girl to read, which is to say you raise the status of women. When women have even that much more power over their lives, the birth rate drops, and it drops really quickly. So we are all going to have to be feminists. You know, like, gosh, what a shame, right? These are things we should care about anyway if we care about human rights, right? We should care about girls getting an education. We should care that girls are not being forced into marriage at age 10 and dying from it. Like, these are things that should matter. Mm. The number one cause of death, in fact, for teenage girls age 15 to 19 around the globe is pregnancy. I mean, we should care about this as a human rights issue. As it turns out, stopping these practices, giving women some human rights, some control of their lives, is the only thing that's going to save the planet, because it's the only thing that drops the birth rate. So the other half of that equation is that the reason that, you know, people have too many children is because of poverty. And the reason people are poor isn't because they're stupid, it's because the rich are stealing from them. And that's called capitalism.
Mm-hmm.
So we're going to have to name capitalism as a, you know, global pyramid scheme. The rich are on top. You know, the Occupy movement had this claim that it's, you know, the 1% versus the 99%. And I think that's self-evident. So again, if we care about human rights, if we care about poverty, if we care about oppression, we're going to have to name the system called capitalism and do something about it. But as it turns out, caring about that is the only way that we're going to save the planet. So over the next two or three generations, if we were able to make justice, you know, the motivating factor of, you know, our actions over the next two, three generations, we would in fact see a really steep decline in the population. Right now, half of the pregnancies that happen are either unwanted or unplanned. All you have to do is give women control over their bodies, and the problem is solved. So one really great example,
in terms of
this has already been...
Okay. Yeah. Yeah, in terms of a global example of an organization, or who do you think would be the catalyst for doing that other than, you know, us each individually acting on our own? Is there an organization like the UN or some other global group that could help make this happen?
Well,
some of those justice
in order
goals.
To do this, in the time frame that we've got, which is very short, we really are going to need most of the institutions on the planet to get behind it. And that's the problem.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not a biological problem. It's not a physical problem. We know where babies come from. You know, we actually know how this happens. We just need the political will to institute a different political arrangement, which is not called patriarchy. It would be called something more like, you know, equality or justice, and that's what we need.
Mm-hmm.
But the problem is that most of the institutions that rule the planet are headed in completely the wrong direction, and this is where we need the political will. So a really great example, bizarrely enough, is Iran. So this is a country that's run by a religious theocracy, right? Very conservative.
Yes.
But they did the math, and they saw that, you know, they were reproducing at the upper limit of what's biologically possible for humans, and they saw that in another generation, I mean, not only were they going to have nothing but poverty, but there was going to be nothing to eat, nowhere to stand, nothing to drink. I mean, they were just going to completely outstrip their land base on every level.
Mm-hmm.
So they had a great big meeting, and everybody who cared about this got together, and they knew the facts, that it's all about education of women, that you've got to give people access to this information, and they developed a plan that was multi-pronged and culturally appropriate. And so they did things like they set up, in every neighborhood, they set up what was translates to like a health house. So it was a place you could go essentially to get birth control. But they couldn't say, well, this is just like Planned Parenthood, because nobody would go. They had to pretend that it was about, oh, you could get your blood pressure checked, or you could get your, you know, whatever, get weigh yourself, or, you know, whatever you needed. But in fact, it was really for birth control. And it was free. Anybody could go and get it. And then they had women who were trained in each neighborhood to go door to door, literally, and ask the women in the house, do you need birth control? Do you want birth control? Do you understand birth control? What questions do you have? What are your needs? In order to get a marriage license, both the male and the female, the man and the woman, had to sit through a class that was all about birth control. Why it's important to limit your family size. So what you can have versus how hard it's going to be if you have too many children. And here's some birth control.
Wow.
It was all free. Then they got the religious leaders on board, and they put out religious sort of fatwas that said, it's not in the Quran anywhere. God does not actually care whether you have a vasectomy. What's important is being able to care for the children you do produce, so do this wisely. And literally the next day, men were lined up around the block to get vasectomies. Because what do you know? They want to control their reproductive lives too. You know, they didn't really want to have 12 children. Who can support 12 children, you know? Your life is over at that point. So everybody got on board. They have the people who write the soap operas and the TV dramas. included it in their storylines, you know, where the younger woman would be asking her mom or her older sister about birth control. Everybody's having this really open conversation about it. They have billboards. And there was a huge effort to keep girls in school. And it worked really dramatically that female literacy went from 25% to 75%. So it was really successful. And in rural areas, they had mobile units that drove around in little vans and did the same thing, educated everybody in the village, asked them what kind of birth control they wanted, you know, explained why it was important, gave everybody what they needed. And this is in real contrast. I mean, when we think about sort of population issues, of course, everybody's mind immediately goes to China and these kind of human rights horror stories
right.
that come out about the one-child policy. It doesn't have to be that way. I mean, you can just simply empower women and empower men as well and let everybody make rational decisions about their future, about the life, about their families. And what do you know? They will make better decisions for themselves and for the planet. So I'll just repeat, mm-hmm. this isn't people versus planet Earth. It really is people with planet Earth. This is really the mm-hmm. only solution we've got. And it worked dramatically in Iran, dramatically. And within 5 years, the birth rate had dropped to just below replacement levels, a little bit further, and they'd actually be heading down, which is the direction we need to go. But you can see how easy it was. By simply caring about human rights, women's rights, you know, and giving everybody the care that they wanted, they did it.
Right. I'm going to do the station ID here. You're listening to High Noon in Lake Worth. I have Lierre Keith, an activist of many stripes, here with us today as a guest on High Noon in Lake Worth, and appreciate you being with us. There were some comments I have on my blog that is Wes Blackmon, City of Lake Worth blog, that I'd like to share with you and just bounce off of you and see what you think here. One was, a trip to Whole Foods or any organic section can deter most from the vegan lifestyle. There may be some wholesale outlets for vegan food products, but I am not aware of any. I guess people are wondering where to go to find the food that's good for them to eat and good for the environment.
The best thing you can do is either grow your own or make friends with a farmer in the area. And the question that I think is the most basic question to ask about your food is this building topsoil or is it destroying topsoil? As so much is wrapped up in this. If you're building topsoil, what it means is, first of all, you're sequestering carbon, because carbon is the basic building block, well, of everything, but of soil. And that's what grasses use to build soil, is they suck carbon out of the air, and that's how they do it. So if you're building topsoil with your food, you're, in fact, saving the planet, you know, one bite at a time. But it's bigger than that as well, because if it's a grass-based farm, what it means is that, okay, so the grass provides a perennial cover. So that's how the soil is being protected so that you can build it. But what's also being created or protected is habitat. And what that means is a home. So on that grassland, on that prairie, you're going to find any number of small creatures who need to live there. So you're going to find ground-dwelling birds. You're going to find small mammals. You're going to find like frogs and toads and lizards and, you know, snakes and all kinds of reptiles and amphibians. And they all, I mean, they're all being hammered right now by civilization. They've just been pushed to the absolute brink, all of these creatures. And by letting there be a perennial grassland, it means they all have a place to live again. And this can happen almost overnight. I mean, I've seen some of these places where they go from, you know, growing corn or wheat or some kind of horrible monocrop, and they return it to grass, and they, you know, put the appropriate ruminants on it, and it's just, there are birds that come back that haven't been seen for 100 years because they finally have food and a place to make a home, right? So that's what you're doing, is you're restoring the home. You're also restoring the water table. It is only those deep-rooted perennial grasses that can, their roots make a channel for the rain. So when the rain falls, if all you have is, say, a cornfield or a wheat field, the rain just, it simply has nowhere to go. It can't be absorbed into the soil. Whereas if you have the deep-rooted perennial plants, the grasses like that, every one of those roots makes a little channel. And the rain can then be absorbed deeply into the soil. And it's absorbed deeply enough because the roots are deep enough. Perennial plants have very deep roots, whether it's trees or grasses. It's deep enough that actually recharges the water table. And then in drier times, like over the summer, when there's not going to be as much rain and it's really hot, then those perennial plants suck that water back up. So it's like a great big sponge, you know, that sort of breathes every 6 months, you know, in and out. And then the grasslands make that water moisture available to the rest of the living community. You can't do that in a cornfield or a wheat field. The roots simply aren't deep enough, so the plants can't do it. The water is restored. It also means that the nearby streams are going to be in good shape because the topsoil is held in place by those roots and by the perennial cover of the grasses. So it's not running off into streams and killing the life of that river, because that's what happens with agriculture. It's all that runoff, and then the streams are clogged with silt, and then the fish can't live. I mean, they're just literally suffocated to death. And I mean, like 80% of the rivers in China cannot support life, and it's not that much better around the world.
Yeah,
it's horrible. I mean, this is like just really grim stuff. And then all of that soil, of course, then clogs the mouth of the river, kills the estuaries, you know, eventually makes dead zones. Now you add some nitrogen fertilizer to that, and you've got dead zones in the Gulf of Mississippi that are like the size of New Jersey and stuff. So, you know, these are our two choices. I mean, on the same piece of land, you can grow a bunch of corn and make a really sick cow and then make some really sick humans, and you've destroyed everything, you know, at the end of the day. Or you can leave it in grass or restore it to perennial grasses, and you've got this biotic community that could go on forever, because that's what nature does, right?
Yeah. What about urban locations? Cities are destined to and predicted to increase their population over the next 20 or 30 years, and more people are moving in from rural areas. How do you see the urban environment responding to more of a need to produce its own food? And what kind of opportunities are there in an urban context?
I don't want to depress people too much. I mean, I think they should do what they do wherever it is they live. But there's no future in making cities. I mean, this is the problem with civilization, right? I mean, the word itself means life in cities. You've got people living in densities that require the importation of resources. And what that means is they've used up their land base. So the food and water and the trees and the energy, whatever it is they need, they've used up their own. And that means they have to go out and get that stuff from somewhere else, right? Because they've destroyed their own land base. So, you know, X million people cannot live on an island called Manhattan. Right, they've got to import the resources. So they've got to import energy, they've got to import food, they've got to import water. There is no way to do it without that importation. And the problem is, once you've made yourself dependent, not just for like fun stuff that you might want to trade, you know, like beads, whatever, you know, obsidian, like the actual stuff that you need to survive, if you have to get that from somewhere else, your civilization, your culture is now based on imperialism and genocide. Because no one is going to willingly give up their water, their land, their trees, their energy to give it to you. So you're going to have to take it. If they won't trade with you, and they're not really going to, you're going to have to take it. And this is the pattern of civilization over the last 10,000 years. This is why agricultural societies always end up militarized. At the end of the day, they use up their topsoil. They blow through it. It takes between 800 and 2,000 years, and then they end up with there's a bloated power center at the middle, and it's surrounded by conquered colonies. And it doesn't matter which civilization you look at over the last 10,000 years, it's always the pattern. Why? Because they're based on drawdown. They destroy their own land base, and then they've got to conquer the neighbors and take what they've got. And eventually the whole thing would collapse, until very recently. And the reason it would collapse was because people could only get so far on foot and using pack animals to bring the resources in. So eventually the whole region would be gutted, and then it would move somewhere else. But it was limited because they hadn't figured out how to use fossil fuel yet to do the transportation part of it. Rome got really big because, of course, the Mediterranean, they could float on boats. So they were able to gut all of northern Africa. Egypt was actually the personal possession of the Roman emperor. That's how important the Nile was to this, because, of course, that's where the wheat was grown. And, in fact, by the end of the Roman Empire, a fun, interesting fact. If you interfered with the offloading of grain from Egypt into any of the Roman ports, it was summary execution. You would be killed on sight. That's how important it was, because they had to feed that population.
Wow.
The only thing that kept them under wraps was the fact that there was basically free food, and everybody knew it. So if you interfered with the offloading of that grain, you would be killed on sight. Anyway, the whole thing collapsed, of course. And the only thing that saved northern Europe from Rome was the Alps. They could not get across those mountains. There just was no way, you know, using horses or mules or whatever. Now, of course, the whole thing's gone global because the transportation's not an issue anymore. So
right.
we're looking at a really
Let's talk about our situation in South Florida. Here we have a piece of civilization that really was established here, Western civilization, about 100 years ago, to a great degree, 110 years ago. And that's when the first train came to South Florida. Before, there were hardly any people here. Now we are a mega region of 5 million people. And it's supported by trains. It's supported by the interstate network. It's on the verge of the Everglades. We have water resource problems. What you described in terms of the situation in China is not unlike what we're experiencing in Lake Okeechobee with the runoff from the farms to the north and then the polluted water going out to the east and west sides and polluting our estuaries. So we are probably the poster child for being one of the worst planned metropolitan areas in the world. So how would that 5 million person mass have to change in order to be more compatible with the Earth? And we can share equally among everyone. What would have to change?
Well, yeah, I mean, this is a 2 or 3 generation project. So the first thing is there's a basic level of awareness that people really have to, they have to get it somehow. They have to be educated. And I think underneath that, they have to care, which means you have to look out at the world and see that the birds and the reptiles and the grasses and the swamp trees and the alligators, whoever's there, that they're your kin. And then every time another species leaves, it's a piece of your soul that's going with them. And we have to feel that. And most people don't want to, because this is a culture that's about abuse and it's about, you know, living with that kind of numbness. But we have to get over that. We have to reconnect with the land, with the life that's here. This is our only home, okay? And those are our brothers and sisters. And from there, you have to ask, so what's the destruction, right? What is creating this mass extinction, you know, before our very eyes? And it is this living arrangement that's based on drawdown. So whether you want to call it industrial civilization or really just civilization itself, I mean, that's the problem. That's what's creating this. So then we have to have, you know, a roadmap out. But it really means facing that this way of life, you know, it was a one-time blowout. And, you know, the party's over, as Richard Heinberg called his book. It's a great book about deep oil. And that's it. The party's over.
Okay.
I mean, he's right. 2 generations maybe of us got to experience this level of consumption, you know, of every kind of electronic gadget gizmo you could ever want. And that's it. You know, we're on the downslope now of fossil fuel, and it's going to be over. So recognizing, you know, both of those, both parts of this, one, we've destroyed the world, we've destroyed our only home, and two, it's going to be over no matter what. I mean, this is not about what I want or what you want or what your neighbors want. This is a fact, okay? It's done. Like, the end was written into the beginning. You know, these are substances
right.
that will not come again. Okay, so all of that sort of awareness and education, and some of it's very emotional, but it has to be done. And then from there, well, how many people could live sustainably in your area? And how do we get from, you know, 10 million to, you know, 500,000, which is probably what it's going to take? So it means a lot of us aren't going to get to have children. We're going to have to make that kind of sacrifice for the future. I did it. I decided not to have children. Lots of us have done it. And it means that the children who are born will, of course, be super loved because, you know, everybody's going to want to participate. But it's going to be a completely different living arrangement because it can't be based on fossil fuel, and it has to be based on first restoring what's been destroyed. So restoring the Everglades, restoring your wetlands, restoring the estuaries, and then figuring out, well, what food can we get from those living communities? So, you know, where you live, it's probably going to be a lot of fish, I would imagine, you know, a lot of seafood.
Yeah.
I don't know what kinds of large mammals live in southern Florida, but I'm sure there were some. So there might be some kind of deer or something, I'm imagining, that should live there as well. I know there are black panthers, right? Isn't that an endangered species where you are?
Yes, the Florida panther.
So clearly they were.
There are Florida.
Okay.
Yeah, Florida panther.
So clearly they,
was probably
they were
the top
eating something.
Of the
yeah, okay. So they were apex predators. So Yeah, so I would imagine there's other kinds of mammals that, that are edible. You know, and then there's ways to do what I would call horticulture that are certainly sustainable, but that's very different than agriculture. So there would be probably fruits and fruiting vines that people would plant kind of in rotation throughout the forests and throughout the wetlands that, you know, would then, you know, provide some food as well. Nut trees, same thing. But, you know, this is, like I said, it's a long-term project. This isn't something that you can do as an individual, which I think is depressing to a lot of people because they want, okay, the five-part, you know, sort of, you know, that 100 easy things you can do to save the planet kind of stuff. So if you do these five things, then you're a good person. That's just not realistic. This is going to take a vast amount of political struggle, political organizing, educational efforts, and really going head-to-head with the institutions that are in charge. And that really means the oil industry. It means agribusiness. These are huge. It means the U.S. government. I mean, you know, they're in their pockets, right? We all know this. So this is not, I mean, this is not lightweight stuff. You know, you've really got to be committed to see this one through. But I don't see that we have a choice with all of life being at stake.
There was another comment left on the blog that I think it's very timely here. And it's a quote by Murray Bookchin, who you may be familiar with. But he said, we do not do the impossible, if we do not do the impossible, we shall be faced with the unthinkable. And I think that's what you're talking about.
Yeah, that pretty well sums it up. But I'm not out of hope.
And
I mean, I still think this can't be done.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Rachel Ivey was a guest on the show, and she touched on the fact that, you know, once you start looking at this, you can be overwhelmed as an individual. It's almost like you're helpless because you realize that your individual efforts are not going to save the world. But what can you do is kind of a pep talk to people who, for example, I have a lot of fruit trees, mango, avocado, loquats, kumquats, tangerines, all kinds of things in my yard, little quarter acre yard here in Lake Worth, which is laid out at about 7 units per acre. What can a person like me do, and what expectations should I have in terms of doing my part? And is what I'm doing really helping?
Well, I don't want to tell people that their efforts are useless because that just leads to more despair.
Right.
I think, you know, any perennial plant that you can get into the ground and help get established is doing something to sequester carbon. So whatever trees or grasses grow in your area, plant them. I used to be somebody who was very committed to only planting native species, but I was convinced by someone who said, look, global warming is coming down the pike. Anything you can get to grow is a good thing because, you know, that's more gene pool, you know, to restart life when this is all over. And there's something to be said for that. So at this point, I'm not any kind of purist. Whatever grows, make it grow, help it grow, get it established. But, you know, we have to think bigger than just our individual backyards because when all of this hits, it's not going to matter what kind of wonderful, beautiful, you know, nonviolent, free-range compost piles we got going. It's going to take us all out. So if we have to really think, you know, what are the forces that are destroying our planet? And if you see that global warming is probably at the top of the list, we've got to stop the XL pipeline. We've got to stop ExxonMobil. We've got to stop coal from coming out of Appalachia. The global economy, it runs on fossil fuel, and it's got to be brought to its knees. I mean, that's what's destroying the planet. So we've got to think in the biggest possible terms. We've got to name capitalism. We've got to name industrial civilization. And we're going to have to create movements that can take that down. I mean, hopefully peacefully, but, you know, this can be done. I mean, whatever people create, people can undo. I mean, that's the thing. None of this is, you know, it's not God. It's not the universe.
Right.
It's just people, you know. It's just human beings who've been given a whole lot of power. Well, we got to take their power away.
Well, here's another comment that was left on the blog, and it deals with people, obviously, and you might know this person, and sometimes I feel like I'm walking through a minefield when I throw out names and wondering, you know, the kind of reaction I'm going to get. But let's see. Great source for feminist activism writing in theory is Sheila Jeffries. She really makes you think about a woman's place in society. Are you familiar with Sheila Jeffries?
Yeah, I love her work, and I also know her as a person, and she's absolutely fabulous. She has written book after book about women, about feminism, about women's oppression. She's written a lot about trafficking, about prostitution, and sexual slavery around the globe. She's phenomenal. I cannot recommend her work highly enough. And she's also a wonderful speaker, really funny, very personable. So, yeah, Sheila Jeffries, go get it.
Great. And she has authored books then? They would be available?
Yeah, she's Australian, but you can still get her stuff in the United States.
Okay, all right. Well, let's talk about a woman's place in society in our Western culture here. And it's interesting you pointed out Iran as being an example of a culture that has at least parenting and the need for birth control and that kind of thing. And that comes from a very unlikely place given the role that women have in their society. And it seems like in conjunction there. How has Western society fared? And, you know, amongst women, you know, looking at the surface of things, women have many more freedoms here.
It's true.
Or do they?
I mean, you know, when we had a great suffrage movement at the beginning of the 20th century, and, you know, there were two generations of women who fought like hell for that and got us the vote and got us some basic citizenship rights. But the really radical ones knew that wasn't going to be enough, that that was a first stepping stone, and it was an important one. Because now women can actually enter the public sphere and have some influence. But, you know, we couldn't stop there. And that's always the problem, right? It's like you win one big victory and then it feels like, okay, so now what? You know, you can look at this from many, many different angles for any political struggle, really, because you do make some headway, but then there's that sort of regroupment where, so what's next? And the problem, of course, is that even as you might make progress in one area, then the culture, you know, the people in power have their backlash. So they're going to take their pound of flesh one way or another. So what we saw after the suffrage movement was, of course, you got the 1920s. And what happens in that time period is that, you know, very interestingly, it's the first time where women's bodies are put under the kind of scrutiny that we now take for granted. But up until that point, it was nowhere near as bad. So all of a sudden, women have to look like teenage boys in order to be attractive. So that the flapper look, of course, is, you know, you're very androgynous and you're not allowed to have breasts or hips and you have to have this, you know, very up and down shape. And so the female fat cell is vilified. This means that women are fighting a war against their bodies that they will not win. And that has continued to this day. And, of course, it's only accelerated as, you know, we live in a capitalist-dominated mass media society. So it's the rule of the image. I mean, that's what has control of us now. That's how the ideology, you know, goes from the powerful into those who are being disempowered. And, you know, it used to be through education and through religion, but now, of course, and I think this is, you know, one way we know that God is a man and he hates us is what the mass media does to the human brain. It's really hard to fight the image. And those of us who are over, say, 35 or 40, we still grew up in a print-based culture. And our brains work really differently than people who have now been, you know, subsumed in the image-based world. You can't fight the image the way that you can the written word. And that is to say that when it comes to women, things have gotten really hard. And they know that around the world, you introduce television, it takes about 18 months, and all the teenage girls have eating disorders. And these are in cultures that have never seen eating disorders before. You know, it was okay to have a female body that was maturing, and now it's not. You're not allowed to have female fat. So what happens is it takes 18 months, and all of a sudden, all these teenage girls are starving themselves to death. So this is the world that we now live in, where, you know, it's, you know, the ruling image of the age is that half-starved, white, you know, blonde, you know, surgically enhanced woman. And she's, you know, nobody, Barbie, yes, nobody looks like that in real life. And even the woman in that picture does not look like that in real life, right? And then you add, you know, all these other layers of this. Like you've got, you know, the whole subculture of pornography, which is nothing but just body-punishing sex, just the most brutal acts now being committed against women, and these young boys grow up surrounded by, they're just saturated in these images, and that's what they think sex is. Mm-hmm. So things are really, on that level, are not looking good for women. And this is just the endless battle that you have to fight. You know, whatever your position in the world, if you're dispossessed, it's always going to, the backlash is always going to take some other form. And it's really easy to look at other cultures and say, okay, so this is the problem with this culture. But when you're inside your own culture, it's a lot harder to say, okay, so these are the problems here. So it's easy to look at Iran and say, oh, well, it's a religious theocracy and women are restricted in these ways. But when you look at this culture, it's, you know, it's always harder when you're on the inside to look at it. Though I will say that the right wing has made this fairly obvious. I mean, the war against women that's going on now, you know, to deny women really basic access to health care, to birth control, to abortion. I mean, they just keep cranking that one up. And, you know, it's not any different than the other religious theocracies that rule around the world. I mean, it's the exact same set of beliefs, and it has the same impact on women.
We have about 10 minutes left. We are listening. You are listening to A High Noon in Lake Worth. I'm Wes Blackman, your host, and we have Lierre Keith, a guest calling in from Northern California today, talking about her work with the Deep Green Resistance movements and other aspects of activism that are affecting our planet in a hopeful way of trying to turn the boat around here and head us in a different direction. And in going to your website, of course, Deep Green Resistance is mentioned, and as well as Derek Jensen, who I guess you partnered up and written some books with. Can you talk about your relationship with him and the Deep Green Resistance movement and what that means to you and what it should mean to us?
So we wrote Deep Green Resistance because we saw a hole in the discourse. Okay, so there's a gap. And the gap is that the problems that we're facing as creatures on a dying planet, okay, I mean, it's huge. And I don't see the environmental movement squarely facing the scale of the problem, which means that they're not offering us solutions that actually match the problem. So we tried to lay out, look, this is what we see, this is the damage. This is this system called civilization. Then you put it on steroids, and it's called industrial civilization. And then you add things like capitalism and patriarchy, and you've just got this, you know, multi-tentacled monster that is sucking life off the planet. Okay, so given that, then we need solutions that match the scale of that problem, and we're not being offered solutions. It's a very odd thing has happened to the environmental movement. It used to be about saving creatures that we loved, places that we loved, living planet as a whole. It has now become, well, how can we continue to fuel a destructive way of life? Oh, I know, if we just apply solar and wind and wave power and, I don't know, hydro, whatever, somehow we will be able to keep this highly destructive way of life going. And this to me just seems insane. Like, why are we trying to keep this way of life going? It's the thing that's killing the planet. And the environmental movement used to know that. Somewhere it got, I don't know, it got transformed into a completely different project, and certainly it's not one that any rational person should be standing behind. We need to be stopping the destruction, not continuing to fuel it. Okay, so laying all that out, what then are the solutions? And so we felt like at this point, which is really a crisis, okay, I mean, there's a lot of very mainstream organizations like the International Energy Association that they say 2015 is the last point at which we can turn this around. Well, that's a year and a half from now. That's how much time they think we've got. At that point, too many tipping points will have been reached, and they don't think there's any way to stop it. So some people put it out a little bit further, but and this is it. This is a generation. We're going to do it or we're not. You know, we're either going to pull this back or it's going to be too late. And I don't make predictions about what year. It doesn't matter. We need to get this started. So, you know, having identified sort of the scale of the problem, the nature of the problem, what then can we do about it? So we lay out a bunch of solutions. So as an organization, Deep Green Resistance is, I mean, we're an above-ground group. We do education and we do activism that is completely legal. But we also advocate for at least considering more militant options. This is not something that I come to with any kind of celebration. It's actually a deep source of grief for me that I even have to suggest things like this, but I don't see that we've got an option. I think that if we include industrial sabotage in some of this, that it's something we should at least be discussing as an option. And the group that I sometimes reference is MEND in Nigeria. They actually don't exist anymore, but they were highly successful, and it's the Movement for the Emancipation of the Niger Delta. The Niger Delta was the world's largest wetland at one point. It can now only be called a sludge land because of the oil industries and what they have done, pumped, you know, millions of tons of, it's just, I don't even know, the amount of oil that has come out of Nigeria is just, it's just unfathomable. But they've, of course, destroyed the delta, you know, by doing this. And what it meant is that the indigenous people who have lived there forever, you know, are all sick. They've been poisoned by the oil. There's everything's dead. You know, the fish are gone. And they have no way to support themselves anymore. So their way of life has been destroyed, their culture, their health, everything. And this is the price that you pay when you pump.
So they're living in the apocalypse, basically.
Yes, they are. They're living in the middle of it. And along came, the first group that tried to fight this was a group called MOSAP, which was led by a poet activist, Ken Sarawiwa, who some of you may have heard of him, but you know, long story short, he and his the other leaders of the organization, they were profoundly nonviolent, and they were essentially murdered by the military government. And there was huge public uproar around the globe to try to save his life, and they couldn't do it. They were all hanged. So then the second generation resistance was MEND, and they decided they had to up their tactics because it wasn't working, and people were dying. So they used very pointed attacks with speedboats, and they would take down oil infrastructure, the oil company's infrastructure, and they were highly successful. They were able to stop one-third of Nigeria's oil output. In fact, there was one series of attacks 3 years ago now where they stopped 80% of the oil flow out of Nigeria for an entire week. So these guys were really good, and in fact, it was quite clear that they had college educations and they'd studied militant movements. In fact, they were so good that they came up in skirmishes against the oil industry's private military, and they won, which tells you a lot. Mm. And I just want to repeat that. The oil industry has a private military. Does everybody understand this? They have their own mercenaries who are highly trained to do things like kill the local people who, you know, want to keep living there and not die in oil sludge. Anyway, MEND is so good that that's in their training, that that's what they were able to do, and they were highly successful. And, you know, I'll put a number on this. That the number of people in MEND was probably about 300. So 300 people who were highly trained and very committed were able to stop at times 80% of the oil output. So when people say, well, this can't be done, it's like, well, it can be done. If you care about the place that you live and you are driven to it, we can stop these people. So, and again, I say this is no kind of celebratory, this is not like a happy moment in my life. It was only through a great deal of grief at the state of my planet that I say that I think we need to be thinking about other tactics. It seems to me that we could do this nonviolently. I mean, I used the strike that was in France in 2010. They had a huge, this was all a labor strike against the, you know, the quote austerity measures. But, you know, in Europe, they still have a real left, and they know what this means. And they shut down the economy for about 3 weeks, and they did it totally nonviolently. And what they did was they surrounded all the oil, the terminals, the offloading terminals, and then all the refineries, and then the emergency storage spots. And it was just human blockades. They just surrounded it, and they wouldn't let the oil in or out. And within 3 weeks, they had totally ground the economy to a halt. But it means millions of people have to do it. So this is really my question to everybody out there. If we've got millions of people who are willing to stand between what is left of this planet and fossil fuel, we could shut this party down by midnight. There is no question. But I don't see it. Where are the bodies? Mm-hmm. Who is standing in front of those coal trains? Who is standing around those oil refineries? You know, who is protecting the Gulf of Mexico? Who is stopping LOOP? It's the Louisiana offshore oil port in Louisiana, where most, I think it's like, I don't know, 40% of the oil comes into this country through those ports. We could stop this. I mean, there's only a few nodes where this stuff happens. We could do it, but I don't see anybody doing it.
We have about 90 seconds left, and we could go on talking about this for a while, the predicament that we're in, our nation, our country, our way of existence, our world, basically. So in the minute that we have left, and we also have the outro music to get in here, I really appreciate your appearance on today's show, Lierre. I will give you the remaining time just to talk about where you're going to be appearing in the coming future, and what's your immediate focus?
My immediate focus is trying to finish my book. And, yeah, I do have some upcoming appearances. You can check my website for those. But mostly I want everybody to stand up on their hind legs and fight, because this is the last moment.
Okay. Well, I appreciate your taking an hour of your time with us. I know it's very precious, the time that we have to use productively, and I think the listenership will get a good idea where you're coming from. You do have a website, larakeith.com. I encourage people to go there and check out your work, and also check out Amazon and Kindle options if that is possible for them. So, Lear, thank you again.
Well, thank you for your show and for all your good work.
Okay. Take care, and have a good weekend. We'll see you next week on High Noon in Lake Worth. Thank you, Lear.
Not the same in other towns along the coast, both up and down. There's nowhere else, just look around. It feels like home to me. It's called Lake Worth in Florida. On any map you'll see, from John Prince Park to Ocean Shore, it feels like home to me.
But I am
a sleepy town most of the time. Taking a show, drink beer or wine. Cool little shops, no waiting lines. It feels like home to me. There's ocean views and fancy cars. Tiki bars where you can count the stars. Be neighbors to Manuel or Lars. It feels like home to me. The parties in the plaza set, a feeling you won't soon forget. It's easy, you just cast your net, and it feels like home to me. We're all can have a place in the sun, raise your kids and have some fun, with festivals for everyone. It feels like home to me.
Geographically challenged rock band delivering a commencement speech.
Hello, graduates! Here's a song called Adulthood is Scary, but Progressive is Snapshot. Plug it in and save money for being a safe driver. Let me hear you, Kansas City, New York?
Safe drivers save with Snapshot from Progressive.
Now you're wearing a stupid hat. Congrats! No, but really, where are we?
Progressive Casualty Insurance Company. Snapshot not available in all states.